Live from the heart of Los Angeles, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright
lights. With tonight's guest, regenerative entrepreneur from Allegria Fresh, Eric Cutter.
Look at the night sky. Look at the night sky.
And performance guest, Vito DeSalvo. I am Mark Leger, and now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
I had the pleasure to be introduced to and to watch the film Pharmacy of Light. I would like to add to learn from and be inspired by the film Pharmacy of Light. And I'll spell that, actually. It's very clever spelling. Farm, as in F-A-R-M-A-C, Pharmacy of Light. I actually took a few notes while watching the film because there were things that I had never thought about before, decidedly, or even known to think about. So I took notes because I wanted to review, research, see what else I could find. One of those things was a phrase that maybe some of you are familiar with. I don't know that I've ever heard, or it didn't land the way it did when I heard it in the film, Victory Gardens. And so I looked it up after watching the film, and I learned so much about Victory Gardens, decidedly, after learning what I learned in the film. And after learning what I learned about Victory Gardens, I was even more excited about the possibilities here. And for those of you who don't know, I'm just going to share because I think it's that important, and now is an excellent time to be thinking about these kinds of things for many reasons, many, many reasons. So many different sources were talking about Victory Gardens online and in different ways. A vegetable garden, especially a home garden, planted to increase food production during war. And why? Because Victory Gardens freed up agricultural produce, packaging, and transportation resources for the war effort and helped offset shortages of agricultural workers. They increased people's health and through physical activity, and their families enjoyed it. The people who got together or made their own victory gardens. They were first promoted, evidently, during World War I. War gardening, or victory gardens, provided American citizens an opportunity to assist with the war effort. Americans were encouraged to produce their own food, planting vegetable gardens in their backyards, churchyards, city parks, and playgrounds. And evidently, today, Victory Gardens still exist, although I've never, don't recall hearing about them, but potentially it's a slightly different purpose. Modern day Victory Gardens combat issues of food security and sustainability living, maintaining health and healthy ecosystems, and strong local economies, support strong local economies. And during World War I and World War II, food rations and shortages in labor and transportation made it difficult to get produce to markets. So the United States government called upon the citizens to contribute to the war effort by planting Victory Gardens. I could go on and on. And as I say, this sounds and feels to me like a perfect time for us to make gardens on our land, in our yards, in on our balconies, and with the kinds of solutions that one would see in the film or we'll hear about tonight, it is, I think, more easy than ever before. So I'm excited to get into that conversation that matters with our guest Eric Cutter, and a little later on with our performance guest, conversation with him, Vito DeSalvo, all on the Life Changes Show coming up.
I am also excited for tonight's conversation and for more talk about Victory Gardens, but I think we're going to need a whole nother show because We should be building victory playgrounds and victory kitchens, shelters, and all sorts of others.
Brilliant. Wow. And there you go. Well, then let's start with this. We've titled this show, inspired by our guest, Now You Can Grow Superior Light-Filled Food Anywhere, Anytime. This is our Life Changers Show, episode 819. Our featured interview guest is a visionary urban regenerative farmer, managing director of Alegria Fresh, and executive producer of the documentary film Pharmacy of Light. Welcome, Eric Cutter, to the Life Changers Show.
Thank you very much, Filippo and Mark. Really appreciate you including me on your show tonight.
And you're welcome, and thank you for bringing that kind of excitement and possibility to people that potentially one can say wasn't there before. But before we get into what that is, there is so much information in the film. As we know, we discussed, people have had to watch it two or three times in order to really, and I took notes. So how did you accumulate this information, or maybe even before that, what inspired you to learn about vegetables and gardening?
That's an interesting question, but it goes way back. I've always been a foodie. My mother is a first generation Dane from Denmark, and she made the finest food for us growing up, four children. So she was always cooking great, great meals, all natural foods and everything else. So I grew up with this kind of food. And as it turns out, I didn't realize my mom was setting me up for many, many years of not being able to go without eating really great food. So as our food distribution system started falling apart 10, 20, 30 years ago, I realized that the only way to kind of maintain that kind of quality, superior nutrient density, and all the flavor of the food that I was used to, was to grow it myself. So that got me into soil, and that's where the whole thing really started.
You know, it's interesting, soil, because something stuck with me that you said. You talked about how the food chain, the base of the food chain in the ocean, yada yada. So talk about that, please. That fascinates me.
Well, I'm of the ilk that I like to look at what's causing the whole problem. And the bottom line is that our degradation of soil really started in the 1980s, and it's been very simply poisoned. We've been toxifying our soil, not only with over fertilizing it, but now with pesticides, fungicides, herbicides that are extremely toxic. And now we're starting to hear a lot about forever chemicals, which we didn't realize what we were putting on our soil, which means they're forever. And so all these things, including microplastics, et cetera, over the last 50 years have resulted in a degradation of our soil systems. And when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, we didn't talk about organic, because everything was organic and it was coming out of relatively clean soil. And, you know, for the last 50 years, we've been pounding on this planet and extracting without really looking at regeneration. And that's where that whole movement, regenerative organic, is coming from. I mean, many organic farmers are technically regenerative because they practice soil health. They're just not, you know, certified yet. But it's become necessary to actually create a new certification called regenerative organic, which is, in my opinion, above organic, in the sense that it not only eliminates pesticides, but it is about soil first. And you really have to understand a lot about plants. They're smarter than we are. If you put a plant in perfectly balanced, high biology living soil, it knows exactly what to do. So I learned a long time ago that I feed soil, I don't feed plants. And it works.
Interesting. And we'll talk more about that in a moment too. You know what's confusing, I'm sure, to a lot of people is food looks good. We get vegetables that look beautiful in the supermarket, right? But
yep.
They don't necessarily taste good or have the nutrients. or something else that you add, light. So nutrients, flavor, and light. So let's take it in that order if we could, or you tell
well,
me.
Well, nutrients, let's back up a second. We're all creatures of light, and that's where the movie Pharmacy of Light comes from. I'm an old biochemist and oncologist by training, and so I'm smarter than I look, I think. But the bottom line is it made me really think about, once again, what is the causal effect of nutrient density? Well, it's light. Soil runs on light. People run on light. Plants run on light. Everything runs on light. Anything that's alive is running on light. I mean, our human cells are exchanging over 100,000 biophotons, which are little packages of light, every second. So every cell, 100,000 little flashes every second. I mean, that's a big number. So if you look at light, and that's something we've been really studying, and how to get more light in soil, first of all, in order to create greater communication links to the plant, because everything runs on light. I mean, the plant communicates via light with the soil. So more light in soil equals more light in plants. And if you can eat plants very close to the time of harvest, that coming out of this very, you know, vibrant soil, you're going to actually infuse your body with more light, which is exactly what I'm trying to change the conversation to. It's not just nutrients, vitamins, phytochemicals, etc. It's how fresh is the food and how light filled is the food. It's the prana. I mean, Eastern medicine talks a lot about light, but we don't. So light filled food equals nutrient dense food equals carbon rich food. Those things are all similar expressions, and they're all very, very good for you. And they all are part of a healing process that creates resilience in human beings.
So you are changing the conversation. And so this, the light, how long does the light last after the vegetable is picked?
Well, that's really interesting. We're not sure exactly, but we're able to measure it from a nutrient density standpoint. So that's another huge billion-dollar business that I'm sure that once we figure out how to start collecting the data on that, we're looking at it. Well, no, but for example, a head of romaine lettuce will lose upwards of 50 to 60% of its nutrient density in the first 3 days after it's cut.
Wow. So,
even if it's the best lettuce in the world. And by the way, romaine lettuce has incredible brain chemicals in it. And so many of us never eat a fresh head of romaine lettuce that when you cut it, it actually bleeds white milk. And that white milk is very, very anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, but after 24 hours, that milk is gone. So if you're not eating fresh lettuce, you're not getting that nutrition in that lettuce. And then after a few days, you've lost 50 to 60, maybe even 70% of that, especially if it had been heated and traveled. So we're actually eating food, even if it did start out incredibly well, we're eating food that's very, very deficient. So pack your body with deficient food every day. Your body realizes that, because your body counts nutrients. It doesn't count calories. We've been taught to count calories. So if you eat a very nutrient dense salad, like one of our Alegria salads, which is, you know, a 6 to 8 ounce salad, you're going to feel really full because your body's going to be full of nutrients. But if you eat a hollow salad, you know, that's old, your body is going to say more, more, more. So we pack ourselves with a lot more calories and a lot less nutrients. And so that's where this whole thing starts to go wrong, is if we start out with food that's not nutrient dense or carbon rich or light filled, we actually have to fill in the gaps by eating more of the deficient food. And so that's how this thing got upside down in the first place.
So, Eric, I'm having a confusion between the light and the nutrients. At first I thought they were different, but it's measured, the light is measured in nutrients?
Well, technically, yes. We have little testing meters that we can use that will actually measure the light profile, and a higher light profile equates to, you know, a higher nutrient level, like a Brix meter. So if you have, you know, more how would you say, without getting too complicated? I'm going to say yes. Increased light equals increased nutrient density. They work hand in hand. They run in parallel. And generally more carbon dense as well, too.
So before we leave this conversation, so the vegetables that look good or fruit and all that, I'm also assuming that it has to be fully grown, or the fruit at least has to be ripe, right?
Well, and not, it's not ripen ripeness. After. It's how it's grown. I mean, they always say know your farmer. I was an expert in hydroponics, and you can grow incredibly good looking food hydroponically, which are synthetic fertilizers, basically salts that are used. And what you're missing is you're missing the biology. So imagine if I said to you, let's increase your resilience, but we're just going to hook you up to an IV and you can't use your gut. And what is everybody talking about nowadays? We're talking about gut health, right? And diversity. Mm-hmm. And thousands, I mean, in fact, tens of thousands of different bacteria in your gut provide diversity. I mean, I'll give you a little number real quick. Most American guts have about 12,000 types of bacteria in it at best, whereas most of the indigenous, you know, say in Africa, et cetera, that are eating a very diverse diet have over 40,000 bacteria. So they have the ability to be four times more resilient because their gut is four times more diverse. In fact, Morocco in the slums, some of the kids that haven't died of disease are some of the strongest guts in the world because they've been exposed to so much, so many different bacteria that if they haven't died, they're stronger than you can imagine. So diversity, our gut plays a major role. And if you're going to grow hydroponic vegetables, you're really growing without the soil, which is, you know, that's hydroponic is soilless. And therefore you're not using the gut. So it's that complex diversity in the gut that makes nutrient density in the soil. So the soil has been referred to as the gut of the earth for that reason. If I put a little tiny bit of soil on the tip of my finger, there's more biology, more creatures on the tip of my finger than there are people on the planet. Over billions of organisms just on a little bit of rich soil. Gives you an idea how complex Wow. the soil web is.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So hydroponically, I'm also thinking that potentially some of them are raised in greenhouses that are covered. Well,
greenhouses, you can do hydroponically or with soil. So it's a difference between if you're soil or soilless. I swear by soil. I'm very, very good at hydroponics, and hydroponics is filling in a lot of gaps. In fact, there's a big fight right now. Should hydroponics be called organic? It is. There are ways to do it organically, but I mean, if you don't have the microbes, and by the way, the word organic is the study of carbon-based chemistry. That's what organic means. And, you know, USDA and the FDA have co-opted the word. So organic technically in soil is the living portion of the soil. It's all the microbes. You've got minerals, you've got microbes. What's missing in really, really good soils is microbes and diversity, because we're killing that with pesticides and over fertilization. So we are disallowing the soil to be as efficient as it possibly can. It cannot transfer the nutrient loads that it used to when it was very vibrant, because it doesn't have the diversity of microbes in it. And so the challenge is to build that soil back up and regenerate it again. And that's the study of regenerative organic.
So Eric, just real quickly back to the light. I'm blown away by this. The lettuce has 60 to 70 less percent of light 2 or 3 days after it's picked. And when the way food is now distributed, I don't even know if it's in the stores 2 to 3 days after it's picked. But so if we bring it home and we eat it a week later or something like that, it might still look good, but there's nothing there for us.
Well, you gets to why do they put lettuce in a bag? They're trying to keep the oxygen away from it. Everything in the world oxidizes. There's oxygen. You come out of your mother's womb perfect, and then you take your first breath and you immediately start to die. but you have to breathe oxygen. So oxidation is a degradation. It ruins the paint on your car. It ruins in your house. It ruins food. I mean, it basically breaks things down. And so oxidation is a natural process that occurs, and it occurs very quickly, especially in leafy greens like lettuce. Now, in beets or anything else, or avocados that have shells on them, it's much slower. But
so maybe this is obvious.
Most of our diets is a broad diversity of leafy greens that are really fresh, hence light filled. And let me go back to something. Every leaf on this planet is a solar panel. Okay. We're also solar panels to a certain extent. We have melanin in our skin that actually photosynthesizes. But every plant uses photosynthesis. It takes biophotonic energy from the sun and with chemicals, and it converts it into light energy. You know, that takes that light energy and converts it into sugars, carbohydrates, and it feeds those carbohydrates in the form of sugars to the soil. Now, those microbes are waiting down there. So that's how a plant takes carbon, which is C6H12O6. That's right. That's sugar. So there's six carbon molecules. It takes CO2 from the air, which is carbon, and two oxygens, and it creates sugar and pushes it into the soil. That's how you actually sequester carbon in the soil. Now, that's a big deal, but the bigger deal is, how do you sequester carbon in the plant and get to eat that carbon? Because our guts need that. That's what all the microbes are feeding on, is that carbon. So really we should be focusing on how much carbon can we get back into the plant, and how fast can we eat that plant from the time of harvest?
So cans are out of the question, right?
Yep.
What about frozen?
What about what?
Frozen food, frozen vegetables. Do they keep some of the light?
Oh, yeah,
longer,
no.
Maybe?
Well, frozen vegetables, you're going to maintain some of the enzymes, but not all of them. So there's another thing that we don't really talk about, is enzymes. Enzymes drive all the catalytic, you know, reactions in our body. And fresh foods loaded with enzymes, frozen foods got less. What is preserved very well in a lot of freezing, or freeze drying especially, is vitamins, minerals, and phytochemicals. So you're getting that. But once again, you know, a raw salad that's freshly picked out of your garden every day is probably one of the most important things that the last three or four generations have been missing. And it's obviously, it's creating massive problems in human resilience and disease, et cetera, because we're not feeding our body what it needs to take care of itself. And once again, just as the plant is super intelligent, if the soil has got everything the plant needs, it knows what to do. If our body gets everything that we need, the body needs, it knows what to do, and it doesn't get sick. So that's where resilience comes in. And that's what we're missing. We're missing that really premium light-filled fuel every day that's going into our bodies to help prevent all the problems we have with the toxic world we live in, you know, from water to air to you name it. So growing your own food, going back to those victory gardens, that was some of the healthiest food in the world. And about 40 to 50% of Americans at one time were growing some of their own food. And that was through the 40s and 50s. That's been lost completely in the last 80 years. And now you see what's happening to our human health and resilience. We're losing it. And a pill will not solve it.
So the movie's not out yet, but when it is, we'll definitely be letting our audience know. In the meantime, though, so I don't want to give it away, but you have figured out, the hard way, obviously, figured out a way to make soil rich through much chemistry and trial and error and lots of hard work and study and all of that.
Yeah. Hundreds of soil trials, yes, to figure out what makes soil tick. Soil is more complex than the moon, you know, going to the moon. And to give you an idea, I think humans have actually, we have recorded approximately 1% of the bugs that live in soil. So we're 99% unknown, and we certainly don't know how all the reactions occur. What we do know is what we need to put together to make great soil. So I call that biomimicry. How does nature do it? If you start looking at nature and stop thinking we're smarter than nature, because we're not, copy her, respect her, and build soil like she does. And so, for example, up here, I've moved up here to Montana. I have chickens. I mean, there's nothing better than chicken poop for fertilizing the soil, getting great microbes, plus a lot of minerals such as phosphorus in there. We use bark fines from trees. We use special minerals, many types of minerals. One of them is called montmorillonite. They're bentonite clays. We use straw. We use all kinds of things, and we build up some of the most rich, amazing soil. And it grows Jurassic-style plants. If you go to our Instagram, we're at Allegria Farms, you'll see some of the 9-pound beets, for example, that we grow religiously. It's just normal, and they grow in 4 months. So we get tremendously, nutrient-dense, large food, 4-foot chard, 1.5-pound carrots, ridiculous. So 6 to 8 pound, purple cabbage. And that's because of the soil. You could not do that in hydroponics. And our tomatoes and grown in this soil, unbelievable. So
now you say
it really
you're
goes
in
back to having good soil. And that's the difficult part for most people, is how to get good soil in their hands.
You say you're in Montana now, where people think, okay, well, sure, you can do that in Montana, but you were doing it here in Los Angeles in Orange County.
I've been in California for 35 years, yeah. We're under snow up here right now, so my soil days are gone until about probably April. It's a little different up here now.
And the brilliance here also is you weren't just doing it in a farm, on farmland. You have figured out a way to do what?
We have a company called, the easiest way, it's called Soxbox, SoxxBoxx.com. Go to Soxbox.com. And we have, I know I'm going to run a little long on time here if I'm not careful. The most important thing we can do is grow nutrient-dense, light-filled food where people live and work, which means grow it in the urban environment in the city. And what is the most inexpensive farmland in the city? Well, it's parking lots. So we finally devised a way to grow, to use our soil, put it in a sock system in a tray above ground at basically about waist height. And we call it a sox box. And we grow some of the finest food in the world over cement in parking lots. And in the movie and on our Instagram site, you can see, you go back some of our posts there and you'll see a beautiful 150 Soxbox farm we did for the Second Harvest Food Bank, and it was wildly successful. We're the first company in the world, I think, to get over 1,000 heads of lettuce a week, 1 to 1.5 pounds of beautiful romaine every week, packaged up at 6 o'clock, literally cut, washed, boxed up, and into their distribution in 1 hour. And so their distribution of 320 different locations was getting our lettuce within an hour. So you talk about fresh food. So that's the key. How do you get super fine food in people's hands quickly so that they can consume it close to the time of harvest? Well, that's what we did with the food bank. The hard part in Southern California, though, was finding enough parking lots that weren't being developed into condos. So it was very, very difficult for me. I built 15 farms down there, and it was hard to keep doing that over the last 15 years. So I moved up here, and now I have my own farm and, animals, et cetera, and nobody's going to move me off of it.
Good on you. What was that phrase you used, the new or the future of farmers market? What would you say that?
Oh, I used to call it a point and pick. People would come in and they would point at what vegetable they want, and then we pick it. We don't cut it and let it sit there for hours. But that's another model that we're pioneering up here. I'm working hard and I'm investing in what we call a regenerative health center in Kalispell, Montana. And we are trying to build a training center, a Alegria World Kitchen to show not only how to grow the food, but how to prepare the food, and have a institute there, a soil institute, where we can teach people how to actually make the soil right here on site. And I've invested several million dollars into infrastructure up here, and we're still looking for a few other partners here to finish this out with, but we've got a good start, and we're going to try to start teaching people. You can come here and stay with us and help us with our chickens and eat fresh eggs and eat, just eat some of the finest food you've ever seen in your life, grown in the best soil. So that's what I'm doing up here. I have a couple months now, though, to wait it out as until the snow melts, but that's the idea.
That sounds very exciting. So the movie again, Pharmacy of Light, Pharmacy of Light, Light. There, we have the link to the trailer on the Life Changes Show page for Eric Cutter, Erik Cutter, Cutter. But you'll also find him, as you said, on Instagram, Alegria Farms, and that's Alegria, Alegria Farms, and on Facebook, and we have AlegriaFresh.com. We also have the links for the socks box, SOXXBOXX.com, and Alegria Pharmacy. So you could go to our page or find him via any of those and learn more from him. I look forward to learning more from the vast knowledge that you have accumulated and are sharing, Eric. And interestingly enough, as we wrap here, what you started to share about where people can start if they can't grow a farm right now, you listed some things that I thought were really important, and I'm wondering if either together we could write a blog post or if you could write it up in a paragraph. We'd love to post it and share with people. But the very first thing, if people asked you, what can they do to start eating a healthy diet? You said detoxify.
Well, that's a big question. Don't forget our YouTube channel that's also located at Alegria Farms, Alegria Farms. We've got many videos up there that'll show a lot of what we're doing. But without growing your own food, which takes some effort, I would say very straightforward. Number one, make a list of the top 20 foods you have in your kitchen. And then Google inflammatory foods and anti-inflammatory foods, and then see how many of those foods fit into each one of those categories. And if you've got a whole load of inflammatory foods there, which is processed foods, etc., that's a good idea to start changing. You want to consume a lot of anti-inflammatory foods. Mediterranean diet, very simple to understand. If you want to Google that, a lot of fresh leafy greens, eat the rainbow, fish, chicken, low on the red meat. That's the best diet. And if you want to really be careful, start looking at buying organic at least 100% of the time, because you can trust that most of that is pesticide free, or at least harmful pesticide free. But the bottom line is, the toxins that we're exposed to are really causing a lot of problems. Even if you eat really good, your body's shorting out. So that's another, if you want to talk about that in more detail, Filippo, some other time, we can get into the chemistry of food, because I can go on for hours about that. And I think that would be something maybe your listeners might want to tune into, so they'll understand why you want to select certain things. But sourcing your food is critical.
You know it. And then
Farmer markets, know your farmer, ask a farmer if he's growing in soil. And I'm terrible at farmers markets, especially on the farmers, because they try to lie to me about something and I nail them. So I could teach you how to do
oh wow.
that. But yeah, that's not fair though. They're trying hard. The
and
farmers
then the
market's
dick
a great place to get fresh food if you can, understand your farm, and go visit farms, local farms. There's a lot of them popping up.
It's potentially an exciting time, along with everything else that's going on that's not so exciting, to be sure. To know that there have been people that have been working tirelessly. Well, no, maybe some of us are tired. I'm sure you are. But have the answers. And I trust that they're getting out there. Thanks for the film. And do tell us when we can share with our audience that they could all go en masse to experience and learn. And because I mentioned it, you had mentioned it actually as number one. Really quickly, detoxify. What did you want to say about that?
I'm going to have to ask you to say that again about detoxifying.
Detoxifying, yeah, our bodies.
Yeah, well, there's another really good way to very commonsensical way to look at that. Go ahead and Google foods that detoxify the body. I mean, parsley, cilantro, many, many different foods are great heavy metal binders, et cetera, that detoxify your system. And that's a great way to start. Detoxify, when I teach advanced health, when I teach in, you know, in nutrition, if I teach you to detoxify first, then we basically start preventing some of the short circuiting that would occur even if you ate good food. Because these chemicals that we're storing, these forever chemicals, are really becoming a problem, and especially the last 20, 30 years. When I was growing up, they weren't. We didn't have this issue. But we dump about 8,000 chemicals. Many of them are not allowed in Europe. But they're allowed in the United States, but we put about 8,000 chemicals in our food supply every year. And having a background in oncology, which is a study of cancer, every time you add another chemical, it creates a whole different type of cancer it can possibly cause. So we're never going to keep up with the cancers if we keep dumping these chemicals in and don't excrete them from our body. You know, our body has ways to do that, sweating and urination, et cetera. But that's not enough a lot of times. So if you can look at detoxifying foods, that's a real, real big issue. That's a great start. And then start looking at the most nutrient-dense foods, and you can look at the top 10 most nutrient-dense foods. I mean, and herbs such as turmeric and curcumin, which has curcumin, and ginger, and add black pepper to that, piperine. And just those three alone, and blueberries. Oh, my God, if you ate that every day fresh, you'd really get a good start to helping your system start to,
wow,
start to battle.
Eric, thank you for sharing all that. And again, thank you for the film. So Pharmacy of Light, when it comes out, we'll let everybody know. In the meantime, you can check out all the other links that we have. The YouTube, of course, page Alegria Farms, Alegria Farms. And AlegriaFresh.com. Eric, it's been a pleasure. Looking forward to more, and all the best to you up there, and may more good things come from your camp, or your farm, I should say.
Thank you so much, Filippo. Really appreciate being on your show tonight. You take care.
Our pleasure.
Happy
Thank
holidays.
You too. Thank you. And with that, we have our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Darlene, and I'm a young 60-year-old professional hotel conference manager. I've enjoyed doing this work for many years, but now I'm getting more and more annoyed with the young co-workers who are just way too needy. How can I ignore their neediness, or is there a way to encourage them to be less needy?
Dear Darlene, it appears that your younger co-workers may be relying on you more than you'd prefer, which can be very frustrating after years of experience in your role. It's important to set professional boundaries in a way that is respectful but firm. Encourage them to be more independent and praise them when they do their jobs well. Let your co-workers know that while you're happy to help when needed, you also expect them to be self-reliant and problem-solve on their own before coming to you. For example, you could say, I've noticed you often reach out to me for assistance, and I'm happy to help when it's necessary, but I'd really like to see you try to resolve challenges on your own first, as it will help you grow and become more independent in your role. It can also be helpful to give them constructive feedback. Frame it in a positive way that emphasizes their growth, while also setting expectations. You could say something like this. You've been asking for help frequently on tasks that I know you're capable of handling more independently. I encourage you to do your best to think through the issue before asking for assistance, and I believe you'll build more confidence in your role. By setting expectations for self-sufficiency and encouraging your younger coworkers to problem solve on their own, you'll likely see a reduction in their neediness. You can still be supportive without being their go-to solution for every issue. It may take time, but with patience and consistency, you can guide them toward becoming more confident and independent professionals.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you feel the need to ask Dorothy a question, please write her at askdorothy@lifechangesshow.com.
Well, for our performance segment, we are featuring a composer, arranger, performer, producer, and educator, and I don't see it written here, but accordionist, and so much more, actually. Vito Di Salvo, welcome to the Life Changes Show.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Filippo.
It's good to be with you. Literally, I have known you such a long time. To have you on the show is truly special for me. And I should say that I've known you actually a couple different ways. Your company, thanks to Lana and you and Mifflin Hills, was selling my CDs. I think you were the first to sell them online when I was singing as an Italian singer when I started out. And I got to know you and your band through the Italian circuit. So Italian is in your blood and was part of everything I think you did, right?
For the most part, yes, absolutely. Yeah. The band I had was a dance band, but I mean, we could go out and play a completely night of Italian music, or we could play a complete night of American music as well. But most of the times it was a kind of a combination of both, you know.
And now, so I always remembered, well, at first I remembered you with an accordion in your hand. And then years later, you had held the baton and were conducting orchestras and traveling around the world with singers that people would know, like Patrizio Buone and the Sicilian tenors, right? And you were on PBS with a couple of them. And so was there a switch? Were you done? You're never done with the Italian music, though, right?
No, I was never able to escape it. But it was my passion, really. I loved it. And in 2007... I had been, you know, I had my group up to that point, and I was an educator. And in 2008, I retired from teaching, which opened a door for me to do many other things. And just, you know, the stroke of luck, Patrizio Buone was in Pittsburgh, and he found me and looked me up and asked me to be his music director. And I was with him for about 7 years and toured all over the world. And of course, his was mostly an Italian repertoire, of course, and he was from Naples, born in Naples in Italy. And through him, I met Giorgia Fumanti, who, you know, again, she was from Tuscany, and it was all Italian music and beautiful. You know, it was right up my alley, so to speak. But it was a diversion from what I had done for many, many years, which was really just have my dance band and play dance music, you know, with we three.
Actually, could we talk about We Three for a while? I actually have a two or three of your We Three CDs, and I was listening to one of them just a month or so ago, and just enjoying it, because it felt like you, it was a natural thing. Like it wasn't forced. The music that you create, I know people try and give a flavor of this or a flavor of that. No, you're it. Like you were doing it. So We Three, how many? We're in We Three.
Well, that's a good question, really. For 26 years, we were three guys. And it started out as I played the Cordovox, which is accordion, electronic accordion, saxophone, and drums. In 1965, we started. And we went 26 years in that format. Then a very good friend of mine was on the road with singing. He sang with the Four Coins and he sang with the Letterman. He was with the Letterman for about 2 years, wanted to come back to Pittsburgh. And I said, well, look, I'll bring you in the band. So we made it four. I didn't let anybody go. We brought Ernie Pointier in as our lead vocalist. And so we had four in the band, but we didn't change the name. We just still kept the We Three, you know. So then I brought in a guitar player. Well, now we were five guys. So it was really kind of comic because, you know, they say any kind of publicity is good publicity. And when we would be, you know, you as you know, get doing the festival circuit, we would have pictures and small articles in the papers and preparing for the festivals. And they would have a picture of We Three, which would have five guys and underneath would say We Three. And so, of course, the radio jocks get a real charge out of that and go all kind of different directions with what that meant, you know. So that was a lot. But it brought a lot of kind of, unexpected publicity to the band, you know. So
nice. Well, what else is fun too is that you one of your pieces was featured in a big movie, Eat, Pray, Love, right, with Julia Roberts and a bunch of other celebrities, and it's at a really fun moment and funny, and it's used really, really well. And in the movie, it only about a minute or so of it is used, so we're gonna get to hear the whole piece here in just a moment. But how did that come to be?
Well, it's a good question, too. At that time, my daughter, I believe it was about 2010, and my daughter Gina was working for us, and she was sending CDs out to all kind of directors in Hollywood and different things. And I guess someone got a hold of it. And the director, what they typically do is they find music that they call temp music, temporary music. And then they, whoever's the film composer is, they ask the composer, I would like something in this scene like this music. But this director for Eat, Pray, Love loved the tarantella that I did so well. He said, forget it to the composer. He says, we're gonna get the licensing and use this piece. They actually used the second track of my band's recording, which was known as the wedding tarantella. It's the Neapolitan tarantella, probably the most famous and popular tarantella. And we recorded that. It was on the same recording as the tarantella americana. So, you know, it ended up, they used part of that. The tarantella americana that was used in a clip where it was done in Rome. And then Tarantella and Napolitan was in Naples, so they the pizza scene, you know. So it was good. We had two tracks actually, but one was original, which was the Tarantella Americana,
which is this one right here. So we're going to get to hear it here pre-recorded, actually, just as it was used in the movie Eat, Pray, Love. Here on the Life Changes Show, we have Vito DeSalvo and his Tarantella Americana. E prosita. Bravo. Thank you, Vito, for letting us share that on the show. Vito Di Salvo. And I want to direct everybody to his website, vitodisalvo.com. He's also on Instagram as Vito Di Salvo Music. And Di Salvo is D-I-S-A-L-V-O. So find his links and a video that we'll talk about actually here with Vito in just a moment on the Life Changes Show page for Vito Di Salvo. Vito, we're going to kind of switch gears. We've been talking about Italian music and you accompanying and actually composing too. I should make a note for myself. I haven't seen the movie yet. Is it That's Amore where you did the score?
Yes, That's Amore. Yep.
That's Amore. Yeah. You've done so many things, it's hard to keep track, but that's one I want to see. So, symphony, we're going to get to share for the first time ever a piece of your symphony, your first symphony that you've ever written. And it'll be the first time it's ever broadcast on radio. And I was wondering what made you go from all of that we were just talking about to writing a symphony?
Well, from high school, I started writing music for band, for concert band and symphony band. When I was in college, I kept writing and I wrote some pieces for symphonic band. And when I went to graduate school, I studied composition and theory and wrote more, you know, I was a band guy because I played the euphonium, which is a brass instrument. And that was my major instrument. It was not an orchestral instrument. And so I played this brass and I was tied to the band music. So I had written several pieces and commissioned by colleges and some high schools to compose music for symphonic band. Now, I had not ever written a piece for symphonic, for orchestra. So I had scored a lot of music for orchestra, a lot. The artists that I was music director for, and they were several, I, of course, scored most of their repertoires for four orchestra. Those artists, you had to be able to go out with just a piano, a rhythm section, a small horn section, and then full orchestra. So, you know, I did a lot of scoring and orchestrating, but I had not written anything original. So my goal was to write something original. So, hey, I thought, let's just start at the top and write a symphony. You know, it was kind of a funny thing, but I did. And so in 2015, I set out to do that. And I had written several little themes and little motifs. And I was still touring at the time and I was busy. And, you know, you really have to focus and just, this is the only thing you do when you're writing something, serious piece of music like this. So I decided that, this wasn't going anywhere. But when the pandemic hit, I was in Las Vegas with the Sicilian Tenors. And of course, Vegas got shut down. We got, you know, the entertainment industry got shut down as well as almost every industry. And so I ended up back at my home in South Park, Pennsylvania. And I told my wife, I said, and you know, Lana, I said, I'm going to go downstairs and work on my symphony. Well, I started spending like 12 to 15 hours a day. And it took me about 6 weeks to write this 38, four movement piece of music. And I say to people, it was kind of like getting on a freight train with no brakes. I mean, once I started, I couldn't stop. It just poured out of me. And I just...
How many hours a day, Vito?
12 to 15 hours a day, every day, wow. Every day. And I did this. So now I had a recording that I made in my studio with all sampled sounds of orchestral sounds, is which you're going to play tonight is actually that. And I, I had all the composition done. And then I reached out to a friend of mine, Paul Silver, who's was a violist with the Pittsburgh Symphony for many, many years and a great orchestral musician. And I asked Paul if he would be willing to helped me edit the scores, the written scores, so that we could present it then to an orchestra. So Paul helped me with that, but it took that part took almost 3 years, good over 2 years to prepare those, the score and the parts, the individual parts for the individual instruments, because it's a lengthy piece of music and it's very involved, you know.
And a lot of instruments.
And a lot of instruments, that's right, the full orchestra. So
and a lot going on, actually,
in
each of the movement, four movements.
That's right. So that's how it all started. And so now, you know, now the idea is we're just at a point where I want to try to get it played by orchestras and get it out into the so the public can hear the piece, you know, because it has not been performed live yet. So we're working on that right now.
Well, we're rooting for you. We've gotten to listen to the piece. And actually, did I notice a little bit of Italian sneaking in there? And was it the second or third movement?
Third movement. Yeah, the third movement. I call it the Vito or the We Three movement, because the third movement is, of course, it's a waltz, which is not uncommon for a third movement of a symphony. You know, a symphony is typically four movements. You can have symphonies that are seven movements, 22 movements, whatever. But a typical symphony is four movements. The first movement, sonata, allegro form. You know, the second movement's an andante or adagio, a slower movement. The third movement is either a scherzo or a waltz. This starts with a scherzo, the third movement, and then goes into this Italian waltz. And you can just visualize the people dancing to that waltz. And then a fourth movement is a sonata allegro form again. So it follows the kind of the traditional form of symphonies. And if anything, you know, I'm not a contemporary writer. I am more a traditionalist, more of a romantic. I write melodies, you know, as you know, with the Italian stuff that I've written. All melodies, you know, and I just that's my thing, writing melodies. So I did that with the symphony as well.
And something I didn't know is, and I don't know how many people these days are writing marches, but I learned from you that you wrote a march. I got to listen to it. And am I also hearing a little bit of a march in the fourth movement?
Yes, there's a point, yeah, where the percussion is in a fashion of a march type style, sure.
Yeah, so there, it's like ragu. It's in there.
It's in there. That's right.
So with that, it's a great time to hear. Actually, so this is it's titled Symphony Number One. Does it have a title also?
No, it's just Symphony Number One.
Okay.
And then there are four movements. It's just movement one, two, three, and four. There are no subtitles for the movements or anything like that. And what you're going to hear is about the last 4 minutes, 4.5 minutes of the final movement, the fourth movement. And when you're going to hear a little bit of the first thing. Each movement has two main themes, and you're going to hear a little bit of the first one. Then you're going to hear the second theme, which is a big grandiose part, and then of course it as it goes through the coda and the ending, you'll hear a little bit of both themes together. So that's what's on the agenda here with the symphony.
Thank you. And so with that, this is a world premiere of at least the piece of the fourth movement that we're going to hear of Vito De Salvo's Symphony Number One, pre-recorded. Vito di Salvo and Symphony Number 1.
Thank you, Filippo.
Thank you, Vito. I'm so excited. Everything you've done it big. So I can't wait. Please do keep us abreast of what's happening with the Symphony Number 1 and the Number 2 and Number 3.
Okay, I will do that.
All the best to you. Thank you for sharing your music with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. It's great. Appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. And thank you for all. You know, how many years did you do We Three?
The 49
years. And within those 49 years, how many weddings or festivals or events would you say you played?
I mean, at one point, you know, we were at our peak, we were doing 100 to 120 gigs a year. And we figured we'd done about 4,000 weddings, plus all the festivals and country clubs and corporate events when they had them, you know, and all that.
Not to mention all the conducting you've done with all these other singers that we haven't mentioned, or performing with other singers like Pavarotti and other people, and even on a jazz album. Look how many people have been touched by your music. It's just incredible, and especially knowing the kind of music you played. It was happy music, and mostly, maybe you did a few funerals, but mostly happy events. So my hat's off to you, and thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Filippo. It's been a great pleasure being with you tonight.
Yeah, and with you too. You're very welcome. A big thank you to our performance guest, Vito Di Salvo, and another big thank you to our interview guest, Eric Cutter. And with that, that is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark Lejeune, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, like ours surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at The Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.